The Six Nations on Off the Ball with Vodafone. Official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. We all belong to the team of us.
Eddie O'Sullivan and Liam Toland listening in. Any tears in your eye, Liam Toland? I have you down as a crier, I must say.
Well, I had some weekend in Twickenham. I started off in Cheltenham on Thursday. Myself and Mick Galway managed to get
Jesus, a miracle you made it home.
It sure was. Let me tell you, it was a tough few days. But getting the train down from Cheltenham on Friday morning after a great day there. We had the Legends game on the Friday evening, which in itself was a challenge. But going out to Twickenham, it was one of those special occasions, wasn't it? Because you knew there was going to be a backlash from England, and particularly the way Eddie Jones selected his side, you felt, certainly I felt, that the corridor of power, the sparks that they pick. When you start looking at players like James Haskell, very, very limited in so many ways around footballing, rugby, and expected a big backlash. And just, I couldn't have expected the opening try. When I look back on it and examined it, it certainly was no fluke. There was very little accident in it. I just loved the way Rob Kearney, where he started his run in following up Sexton's kick. It was very obvious that was pre-planned. It was very obvious it was pre-loaded, and that the kick was quality. For Ireland to get up to three tries before half-time, certainly at half-time I was saying, oh my God, England have blown so many opportunities. I thought their shot selection in particular was very, very poor. They attacked one side when there was a weakness on the other side, or they didn't really expose Ireland when Ireland were at their weakest point. And at half-time you felt, well, we can win this game. We can almost even coast through to a Grand Slam final. Mm. And considering the challenges of the season, selection, just the outside centre challenges alone, you kind of say, what an amazing achievement. But when you listen to 1948 and you go the jump from 1948 to 2006, and you kind of think, well, it's only a few short years to 2000, from 2009, sorry, to now. But we've been so expectated, we've been enjoying so much success, that all of a sudden, I think the Irish psychic of this particular team is, this is where this team belongs. Mm-hmm. And it isn't a fluke. It isn't something that, look at, if the referee gives us the odd chance, or if it rains or something like that, it seems that this team can kind of battle snow, rain, sleet, a good solid turf. And I think all the luck has now gone out of it. I think this is a quality side. And it was just a wonderful experience. It really was a wonderful experience in Twickenham.
Yeah, I can imagine. Jealous you got to be there. Eddie, as Liam says, this was not last gasp. There were no histrionics. There was no late drama. There were no blood and guts required. It was comfortable. I appreciate maybe a little bit stretched towards the end with the significant number of injuries and the age profile of the team at full time. But from the opening moments, a controlled Irish performance, and Brian O'Driscoll in here yesterday said he was actually disappointed with England. He thought, if nothing else, for 10 minutes there would be emotion and blood and guts. And you know, you talked last week about that side of things maybe covering over the cracks of English failings. And I don't know, did Ireland just so brilliantly control the game, or actually is Brian right? Did we see a slightly disappointing English performance from an emotional point of view?
I thought they were quite flat, actually. In the first half, I thought they were flat. I thought we were all over them like a rash. And then I think we got the emotion at the start of the second half when they were down three tries. That to me was their first state in the second half, but they just threw the kitchen sink at us. And then there was that neck roll on Rob Kearney, penalty, cleared our lines. Next scrum, we drove him back and won a penalty. I thought that was 10 minutes in the second half, game was over, just over. There was no way back from, they were done. Mm. I thought in the first half, I kept thinking, you know, we're going to win this game, boy, we're going to win it comfortably, I thought. And then I thought, well, you know, maybe they get a score early in the second half, it's kind of back on, but it wasn't. They couldn't break us down. Broke us down in the end, but I just felt we were completely comfortable throughout. Now, part of that was how accurate we were. Like, this is the first game in the championship where we've had less possession than the opposition.
Yeah.
In fact, we only ended up with 46% possession and 42% territory. But we were so efficient in our executions. You know, we got basically three chances and we took the three of them. And the other thing that's been a hallmark of the team is that they have this understanding that if you can score before half time, there's a whole psychological dimension to it. So against Italy, Wales, Scotland and England, we scored in the red at the end of all of those three halves. And like, we broke Scotland with that try before half time, and I think we went similar to breaking Wales, and I think we broke England as well, because the difference in the change over half time, when you've just conceded a try or just scored one, is night and day.
Yeah.
So I just thought we were comfortable throughout. I mean, all England's woes came back to haunt them. You know, their ill discipline, their problems in the back row, their defensive foibles, the fact that, you know, Big Watson couldn't catch the ball, the high ball. He was always going to be tested, and he lost the first most important one. So, like, yeah, I thought we were well ahead of them. I mean, there was probably talk at the start of the season, the Six Nations, that this was, you know, the game of the, between Ireland and England for the Grand Slam, and whoever won that would have bragging rights, you know, as being champions of Europe and possibly putting pressure on the All Blacks. There's no doubt who's holding that, that garland at the moment.
Yeah. I do want to talk to you about the future and compare maybe how the 09 team evolved post 09 or maybe didn't, and what the 2018 version will have to do. But I just want to play a clip of Brian O'Driscoll, who was on the show yesterday, because it ties in a whole host of different things. It's a slightly long clip, but I think it's worth it. Not least Joe Schmidt and his ability to dream up moves. So we were talking, or Brian was talking, about the CJ Stander try and that move with Tadhg Furlong and his beautiful hands and pirouetting to set away Bundiaki. So I put it to Brian that this was an old move, the Sexton loop, that maybe originated in Australia, and Eddie Jones is very familiar with it, and obviously Joe Schmidt is familiar with it, and so there was an element of, you know, he knows that I know that he knows that I know he knows, and so on, and that Schmidt actually, the way he designed this move, rope-a-doped Eddie Jones. And here was Brian's analysis last night. People can download the full thing in this section. Here was Brian's analysis of that try last night.
The second one was rope-a-dope, absolutely. I hope that's your, they're your words, not mine, and before I get quoted on them.
Brian O'Driscoll, Joe rope-a-doped Eddie. Great.
The loop play isn't as simplistic as everyone makes. There's lots of different varieties. There's the inside loop where it, you know, it's a simple wraparound. There's also what's known as the Brumbies play, where the first man hits the second guy and then there's a short runner outside him and then it goes between the two. So there are, it's not maybe just, oh, Ireland do the loop play or Leinster do the, yes, the loop play. There's a bit more to it. This was very, very clever, though, because of the personnel there, because we had Stander running the short line to sit them inside, because Levy also, it was actually a tunnel ball between the two of them to Johnny Sexton to sit the inside defence. Yeah, ball. So in front of Levy, behind Stander, you know, tunneled through to Johnny, who then shifted on really early. And that's the secret on this particular loop play. On a lot of other loop plays, he'll try and straighten early, sit the defence down and then throw the pass and then come on the loop if he wants to get it back. But he threw this one really early.
Okay.
As if...
So what does that tell the defence?
He just sold it. It's okay. Like, it's a very small modification, sure, to the way he does it. But he threw the pass laterally, and which is something that he doesn't very often do.
And sorry to interrupt, what message is that giving the defence then?
It spells that he's doing the loop play early.
Okay.
Right? So sometimes, by hitting it straight and then throwing the pass and coming on the loop, you don't know exactly what it is. By him throwing that pass early and getting on his bike, you know immediately that the loop play is about to happen.
He tried to make it very obvious to them.
Correct.
I'm Johnny here and I'm doing the loop play, everyone.
This is the loop play that you've seen so often. So, you know, how are you going to defend it? I'm going to get it back now in a second.
Yeah.
So how are you going to defend it? You're going to follow me around the corner, as Owen Farrell did. Mm. He actually gets excited, realizing that I'm going to get him.
Okay.
Because when we played against Argentina years ago, when we used to do it with Ron O'Gareth, Felipe Contepomi used to do that at 10. He used to always chase Rog around and try and get to him. You sometimes break the integrity of the line, because if someone steps back in, there's no hustle to chase there, but it's a risk that sometimes he was willing to take, and he had some success. Mm. So Farrell obviously saw that. They've been on Lions tour together. He likes the loop play. This is the loop play. and then the brilliant Stockdale's out the back showing intent that they're going to go wide. You've got to have animation there. That's really important. And then you've got Tadhg Furlong Furlong, who's a tight head prop, he's not going to have anything too flashy of, you know, skill wise. So you haven't had, you don't have Gary Ringrose in there. You've got Ty Furlong, so it must be just a bog standard loop play. And then you've Bundyaki outside him, who's kind of nonchalantly running up and looks a little bit disinterested that maybe he's gotten his timing wrong. And then you have this beautiful pivot pass from Ty Furlong as Johnny is coming around, and the timing of it all happening. Johnny's just about to come around the back, and Bundy's just a fraction in front of him. You've got Farrell chasing
Johnny.
You've got Ben Teo about to read in and kill Johnny on the other side. He's like, the loop play's coming.
Yeah.
And then the little slip play, as it's known. And then Bundy through. Gary Ringrose flooding there immediately, obviously thinking that's where they might have thought what the obvious try was. But credit to Watson, he got back and covered Ringrose. Johnny May got to Bundyaki, but that skill to throw that pass to Stander, who then made himself available after running that decoy, was a magnificent piece of skill from Bundyaki.
That's Brian O'Driscoll, Summer Brian O'Driscoll, speaking last night. He kept talking about that try in detail for another 3 minutes, but we do want to get back to Eddie O'Sullivan and Liam Toland. Liam, when we talk about detail and what Joe Schmidt gets up to, I think that's worth playing because it's a lovely insight into just one move, one bit of preparation. But when we're talking about Joe Schmidt detail, we're probably talking about those instances like that times about 1,000.
Yeah, but you know that when we reflect on the detail that Joe Smith is bringing to the Irish team, and the players themselves are driving that too. So I think that one of the gifts that Joe Smith has given Irish rugby is that the players now are hungry to drive that detail themselves now. They're not waiting for the master to do it. But the flip side, England are also doing their homework. And what I really loved about what Ireland have developed over the last while is that there's an intelligence about that detail that England simply don't have. In other words, as Brian described the move that has evolved there, that the English forwards and the English backs, I don't think at this point in their journey, have the intelligence to be able to say, hang on, something else might happen that we haven't prepared for. And we saw that, remember the debacle last season with the Italian breakdown. They understand the breakdown laws. Yeah. And the English players, like I'm talking about, again, James Haskell, like he's 60, 70 caps for England, and he's going looking to the master, the referee, help here, I don't know what to do. And I think that in all of this detail and all of this preparation, I think what's of crucial importance is the level of footballing intelligence. And you take someone like a Tadhg Furlong and you go, hang on a second, we've been watching him, and especially him and Scott Fardy and Leinster, they've been doing that all season. They're either on the ball, sucking in defenders, they're running decoys, they're asking massive questions, and then they're selecting right in the gain line, which is really, really tough for any, like I'm sure Brian would admit that for him himself as an international outside centre to do it is difficult, but ask a tight head prop to do it, and then to select the correct decision, because part of all that is there's still, Tadhg Furlong still has to make the decision who he wants to pass the ball to, depending what the England players are doing. I think there's a huge differential between rugby intelligence of what England are, where Ireland are, and I think that's one of the things that isn't being commentated on all week,
right?
That the level of just knowledge, what to do, when to do and why to do, I don't think England have that. Like, so many times England made life hard for themselves last week. I think Ben Teo really struggled about just when to pass the ball, when not to pass the ball. And I think they're miles behind on what we expect our players to do, our elite players to do.
Yeah, it's quite extraordinary. Eddie and Liam, I'll bring you in this as well. Can we look ahead then to the next 18 months, which culminate obviously in a World Cup? Gordon Darcy in his Irish Times piece today, Eddie, was making the point, the biggest challenge for the next 18 months is in the top 2 inches. And he said, we did not evolve post-2009 like we needed to, for many reasons, and like the current team has the potential to do. And he said he was talking about personnel and styles of play. So, you know, Joe Schmidt has a number of questions. For instance, next challenge up is the Tour of Australia. How important is it to go all out and win that? How important is it to rest Johnny Sexton or not? He won't want to be rested, or the likes of Conor Murray. Do you bring your strongest hand? Do you not? And then obviously we slingshot into the All Blacks in November.
Well, it depends on what he wants, but I think comparing 9 to 18 is slightly different. I think in 9, that Grand Slam was the end of a journey, probably for a lot of players on that team, you know.
Yeah.
This is the beginning of a journey for a lot of those players. Like the following players, Jacob Stockdale, Jordan Larmour, Gary Ringrose, Robbie Henshaw, Joey Carberry, James Ryan, Dan Levy, Josh Van der Fleer, and the reporter, Tadhg Furlong, all 25 or younger. Some of them as young as 20. Mm. Geordie Murphy and Emerson, 26. Mm. So the core of that team is very young. So they're on the beginning of a journey, not the end of a journey. So that's worth remembering as well, you know. So there's this team can kick on to create things. The age profile would say that. And you still have Sexton, and you have Murray, and you have Best, and you have Kearney, and you have O'Mahony, kind of the senior players driving the bus, you know. So that's a really potent combination. But where does George Smith go next? It depends on what he wants. Like, there's a number of things on the table. I think that the run into the World Cup is in three blocks plus one, the World Cup itself.
Yeah.
The next one is the tour, the summer tour. Then there's the All Blacks. Then there's the Six Nations. Then there's the World Cup. So I think he takes it in blocks. The thing that's running under all this is that if they were to kick on and they were to go to the Southern Hemisphere and win a test series in the Southern Hemisphere, hasn't happened since 1979.
Yeah.
Right, that's a long time. That's on the table. Australia are very beatable. We're good enough to beat them. Then we have the All Blacks. That's bragging rights for who's the best team in the world. And then there's the Six Nations. So I think he has to take it in those stages. But he has to probably roll the dice a little bit, possibly on the summer tour. Again in the autumn, maybe not against the All Blacks. We just have to put people like Marmion on the field to start, and Carby on the field to start, and Lorimer to start at some point, you know. Because it is a big difference coming off the bench for a cameo role with 10 or 15 minutes to go if the game is in the bag, or, you know, filling in for a blood bin or something. Like, it's a big difference being told on a Monday you're playing next weekend, and yeah, the whole build-up to it goes with it. So he probably has to expose some of those lads to that. He has the options, though. He might expose them all at the same time. But if they were to go undefeated through the summer and into the autumn, they would play the All Blacks with a chance of setting the world record of 18 games undefeated. So that's another thing there that, you know, those opportunities are maybe once in a generation.
Yeah, they're on 12 at the moment, aren't they?
Yeah, but if you do the count,
they three could in get Australia. To
that game. Yeah, and then there's three in the autumn, you know. They've got Italy away, so that could be pushing them up to 18 games in November. So, look, they're all things he has to consider, but I think probably the most important thing is to continue winning as well. The whole energy out of winning is extraordinary in terms of just energising the squad, boosting them, giving them confidence, and the fact that they will kind of just get more and more confident in their skins the more they win. It becomes expectation rather than a hope, you know?
Yeah.
And they've won so many games now that, yeah, he has this juggling act to do, but if he takes it in those blocks and he's smartly selections, as he has been, to his credit, he's made smart selections along the road, he can still blood those younger guys a bit more, give more responsibility, more start time rather than bench time, and he can keep the show on the road. But he does have to kind of plot his way through it, and I think the way to do it is in those three major blocks, and then into the World Cup.
Yeah, Liam, your thoughts on it? Johnny Sexton, by the way, just to throw his thoughts on this into the equation, and I know he's I dare say he wants to play every game, but he said of the Australian tour and how seriously to take it, we can beat teams at home, but you don't get a home game at a World Cup, and we have to know that we can beat these big teams away from home too, was the point he made. With time slightly against us, how do you think Joe Schmidt may map out these three blocks that Eddie's talking about? We sort of know the Six Nations will be taken seriously. It's Australia is maybe the one he has a bit of latitude with.
I'm not so sure. Certainly any player worth their salt will want to travel to Australia, even if their banjax or leg is hanging off. I think I'd approach it in terms of adversity. And I would say, in winning, Ireland have had to negotiate so many different challenges that will stand to them in the World Cup. And if they go to Australia, and of course they can bring Johnny Sexton and he can play the first game and maybe manage it beyond that or something. But I think Australia present a different set of challenges, as does the All Blacks, all of which go into the memory bank and into the muscle bank. I think it's of crucial importance to keep winning and keep managing the adversity as you go along. And I think Joe Smith will select on that basis. Now, whether he brings his entire team out and then drip feeds them back home after a test or second test or whatever, I don't know. But certainly the value of winning and handling all the different challenges is too important not to want to keep doing it.
And last point then, Liam, I saw the RFU came out and gave Eddie Jones what in football terms we would call the dreaded vote of confidence. He goes to South Africa in the summer. There's no doubt in your mind Eddie Jones is going to make the World Cup. Things would have to unravel in an unforeseeable kind of a way. Or do you think things are potentially about to do so?
Well, I just saw him flip-flopping enormously last week in his total change of selection, which then leads into a total change of vision. So I'm confused by what game plan he wants to play. And if I'm confused as a guy sitting in the stand, what are his players thinking? How is he selling this? Is he going to lose the dreaded, the classic one? Is he going to lose the dressing room? I believe he's flogging his players to death. They look absolutely exhausted. And you factor in on top of that the Lions and then the difficult championship and the amount of minutes played. And you think, well, what is he at and what are the players at? I don't know what style of rugby an Eddie Jones team is playing based on what I saw against Ireland, England. And I thought they were very, very poor in an awful lot of aspects of what they did. Not to mention, just as Brian was saying the other night, you were suggesting that they just look flat.
Yeah.
So they look exhausted. So where did they go from here? What's their game plan? What's the philosophy? That's their problem to figure out. Mm. But the key thing here is, like, England came second last in the table, yet they scored the second most tries. Their points differential is quite good. They're doing an awful lot right. They just didn't win games for whatever reason. If they can figure that out and adjust their game plan a bit, I think their 10, 12, 13 is still too complicated. Their back row is all over the place. But I think playing Courtney Laws at 6 and playing Launchbury in the second row cost them hugely, along with other selection problems. So I don't know how Jones is going to manage to get himself out of this, but he's already thrown a lot of his players under the bus, which I don't think is the correct way a coach should be operating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Final word to you on Jones, Eddie.
Yeah, I think he's struggling at the moment. I think the chickens are coming home to roost in terms of his midfield. Is like his options are very limited in his midfield. He's got Farrell, Teo and Jonathan Joseph, and that's, I don't know how many of those three will get into our midfield. Probably Farrell is the only one, but he's his best 10, and you saw that the dithering at the end, like the putting Farrell into 10, dropping George Ford, and that didn't work out well in terms of the midfield, didn't bring Ant into the game. His back row is still a problem. He gets believe in a fall back if he's lucky, he doesn't get injured again, but he still doesn't have an open side. They are two major sections of your team that are not functioning well. I think that they do look tired, England, and they will freshen up by the time, you know, the World Cup rolls around again. Like, we have the best player management system in the Northern Hemisphere. Mm. And for that reason, the worrying about Sexton and resting guys, I don't think we don't need to rest guys. They've had already enough rest this year to come into the season. So I just think we have a huge advantage there. But I think he has a lot of navel gazing to do, Eddie Jones, to figure out where he wants to go next. But his problems haven't evaporated. And unless he fixes those major structural flaws in the team, I think he will struggle down the track again, because they'll re-emerge again when the pressure comes on against good teams like Ireland or New Zealand.
Okay, lads, we'll leave it there. My thanks to you, Eddie O'Sullivan and Liam Tolan. Short break.
The Six Nations on Off the Ball with Vodafone. Official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. We all belong to the team of us.